Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and today my guest, I'm excited to say, is Charles Burns. He's published two-thirds of a trilogy, which began with his book X'd Out. Now we've got his new graphic novel, The Hive. It's almost unbearable not to have the third book, but while we wait, perhaps there'll be some questions that you'll have had answered here. Now, you seem to be the genius of unpleasant textures. How does that happen to be?
God, I mean, I don't know. It's I'm not trying. I mean, it comes naturally to me. I don't know why I was drawn to darker things when I was growing up. I grew up in the 60s, and my feeling is that there was, you know, the world that was around me was fairly bland and fairly, you know, safe. I grew up in Bethesda, Maryland, outside of Washington, D.C. But right around that time, there was this, like on television and in the media, there was this fad about monsters. And for some reason, that just clicked with me. There was something kind of dark and mysterious and very rich about that whole world. I remember going to school. I didn't have access to those things. You know, I was in a neighborhood that was, you know, not around stores, but some kid at school would have a monster magazine, and I'd have to figure out what I could trade with them to get, you know, get my hands on that. And again, I don't know what was so fascinating, but there was something, like I say, something very rich and exciting that I was drawn towards.
I see. You know, like just out of the corner of my eyes in your books, the kind of worlds full of interesting and strange things, you know, they're seen out of the corner of the eye. Mm-hmm. The frames are very populated, and you have to work a little bit to see like these things that look like hanging meat, hanging from the side of a stall.
Right.
The meat isn't the food, it's the worms in them that are going to be consumed. And figuring out in your things what things are for and what, you know, what makes for the world becoming unpleasant.
Well, I mean, one thing, there's a sense in these books that I'm trying to get at. The format and the look, it's the first time I've worked in color. They're based on the Tintin books that I'd looked at when I was a kid. I was born in 1955, and it was an era when comics were really frowned down upon. They were looked at as just being trash, and they're actually looked at as being something that could cause juvenile delinquency. But for some reason, my father, you know, he was a careful parent. He looked at what I was reading, but he liked comics, and he would bring collections of classic comics home from the library. And the first real book that he gave me that really felt this like it was just mine was this it was an American translation of a Tintin book, Secret of the Unicorn. I got that book before I could read. I mean, they were read to me, but I would sit hours and hours poring over those books. And there were elements in there that I couldn't understand. I didn't know what they were. There's one moment where Tintin is down in this dark, you know, basement of a mansion, and he hears this voice, and he's scared. He's obviously scared, and he's following the sound of this voice, and there's this voice saying, come closer, come closer, come closer to the intercom. I had no idea what an intercom was, but I'm looking at this hole in the wall, but it looks to me like this you know, mouth that's embedded in this wall. So in this book, there's some elements like that, this kind of very dark, strange elements that keep reoccurring and in different situations.
Reading X'd Out and now The Hive, I think, well, if I know anything, the questions are not going to be answered by the third book, by Sugar Skull. And yet, what part of reading is wanting to tear the secret from the writer? you know, we're waiting for this next book. And it's not that it's going to be able to satisfy us.
Right, right, right.
It's how will we accept the kind of dissatisfaction you choose? Are you feeling up to it?
Gee, I sure hope I am. And that, you know, that's what I'm struggling with right now. I'm in the middle of this third volume, and I've got all these threads that are out there, and I'm pulling in this thread and this thread. And everything's planned and constructed. Everything is in there for a reason. Again, maybe it's never going to be fully explained necessarily, but everything's in there for a reason. And yeah, I'm not interested in answering those questions necessarily. The questions always seem more interesting to me, the possibilities, that kind of mystery. Not like a, you know, a mystery novel necessarily of like, you know, here's all the clues and you finally solve the mystery. Yeah, that's not the way it works in real life. There's just, you know, an endless array of questions.
Well, what I've been wondering recently is that feeling that the questions are better than the answers. Is this a feeling of our time? It feels very modern, at least, you know, from around 1960 on, mm-hmm. that a mystery had to have no answer.
Okay.
Someone called it the whodunit becomes a whodonut. It's a mystery with a hole in the center. Isn't that good?
Very good.
It was Jeffrey Hartman who said it. He was writing about Raymond Chandler.
Okay.
But I became interested in that whole thing. Why have we become into the romance of the unsolvable mystery?
Oh, that's funny. When I've done both of these books, when I went on tour for the first book, one of the first questions was like, when's the next book come out? In the same thing with this, it's you know, I think, yeah, I've had these cliffhangers and that sort of thing, but I think people that I've talked to who enjoy it and are finding their way into the story have said, oh, I've read this, you know, the new one three times and went back and read the first one. So there's imagery and ideas that start to build and accumulate and start to resonate with each other, and you're seeing this repetition of imagery that starts to take on new meaning as you continue. That's what I'd like. I think you can read through it and have this kind of, you know, this some sense of the story, but I like the idea that there's a lot of possibilities and interpretations as you're reading.
Well, the thing that I enjoy as I'm reading is it keeps the books X'd out in the hive, keep putting me into situations. I'm the kind of person, I can't put my hand into a hole unless I know what's in the hole.
Right, right, right.
It's too possible for there to be a snake or some unmentionable goop
that
I'll never forget the feeling of.
Right.
Even in movies, I remember one movie in which a hero had to retrieve something from the bottom of a tree stump. Sitting there twitching with a kind of empathetic anguish.
Right.
What is your relation to, you know, the unbearable?
God, I don't know. I mean, in some cases, it seems like in my stories, I'm trying to get at all that internalized fear that I have and find some physical manifestation of that. Find, you know, look at it in the surface details of things. I mentioned that the intercom of, you know, thinking about this, you know, this disembodied voice coming from a wall. You were talking about, I don't, reaching your hand into a hole. I think of Roman Polanski's movie The Apartment.
Tenant.
The Tenant. Thank you.
Oh, it's
where
one
he's
of the
where
scariest.
He's got this. There's just a hole in the wall. There's a tooth in the wall. There's no explanation necessarily for that, but you feel this, you know, the immediacy of that horror. And it's not like, you know, a spooky movie where something's going to come banging through the window. It's something much more internal and something that you, you know, a visceral reaction that you have when you're watching that.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Charles Burns about his new graphic novel, The Hive. You know, people talk about repression and its relation to terror.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there was a time in the 50s when a certain kind of hip, modern pop art said, we share a secret. We both pretend that we don't know what it's like to have sex. But I'm not going to pretend anymore.
Right.
Look at this art. I'm going to show you what this looks like.
Sure.
And you're going to respond not with being titillated,
right,
but with fear, because I'm going to rip repression off the surface of things.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think early on, again, we're not talking about my earlier books, but I think earlier on in my stories, I worked for publishers that never edited my work in the sense of saying you can't show this or say this. But I think that I did censor myself in a certain way. There were things that I just was not uncomfortable. I mean, I was very uncomfortable with thinking about or at least bringing out in my work. And there was a very deliberate choice around the time that I started doing my story Black Hole, which you haven't read, but hopefully you will sometime, that I didn't want to censor myself. And it was a very deliberate moment for me. That's carried on into these books as well. There's some things that I struggle with. Sometimes when I'm taking notes on the story where it's like, this is something that I don't know if I can deal with this. But that's interesting to me. That's something that I want to explore. Can I draw this image? Is this something I can face up to? And you're talking about, exploring sexuality. I want to have that as a normal component in people's, in the characters' lives. That's something that you think about, you deal with, not something that's a titillation, not something that's this is going to sell some, you're going to have a cute naked girl in this book and it'll sell more copies. That's not my intention at all. It's a part of the fabric of, anyone's life.
Well, as I read them and they were new and exciting to me, but I said, these aren't comic books. These are more like surrealist novels. This is like Max Ernst, The Hundred Headless Woman.
Okay.
And I love that. And I would say that, like, the watch cry, the motto of books like that is, I know something you don't know, and that there's a deliciousness about going deeper and deeper in, and the sense that every penetration that you make through a hole, into a cave, into a parallel universe, you're not going to be able to get back.
Right, right, right.
And that the thing that the artist knows that you don't know is something that you're going to learn while you're here. And ideally, it's going to change your life so that you can never go back to being the person you were.
Right, right, right. Yeah, I mean, part of the mystery in this series of books that I'm working on is the fact that the protagonist, the lead character, there's something that he can't face up to. The imagery, the story circles around a center and is slowly, slowly moving towards that center. But the story circles around the character circling around it in the beginning of the hive says something to the protagonist, says something to the effect of, I tried to tell her everything. I tried to tell her the whole story, but I couldn't. So you're seeing these fragments. You're seeing a little bit more information. It's alluding to this. There's one of the very first scenes in the hive you're seeing a younger version of Doug who's waking up and his girlfriend's getting dressed and she's saying something like, do you remember that time we did it in the shower? And he's going, what? So we know that's got to be pretty important. And and she's saying, well, I'm late. This is an important component of the story. So it's not explaining what that is. There's nothing, for me, there's nothing, worse than that kind of explanation of here, A plus B equals C. So it's circling around those ideas and I promise to the best of my ability, it will come to that center by the third book.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Charles Burns about the second novel in his trilogy called The Hive. We're talking about the whole structure of the trilogy, and we'll continue after this short break.
I'm Connie Alvarez, producer of Bookworm. Check out our other KCRW programs in the podcast section of iTunes. Shows like DNA, Good Food, The Treatment, Unfictional, and The Business. Or listen on KCRW's smartphone apps. And thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. And I'm talking with Charles Burns about his new graphic novel, The Hive, part two of an innovative trilogy in which the protagonist, Dog, finds himself in an alternative, nonlinear world. Now, one of the things about Dog is that he's an art student.
Absolutely. He's you know, it's I was an art student. So, I mean, the stories that I can tell are based on the things that I know about, that I can speak with some authority on. And yes, I did every pitfall of, you know, every art student I've talked to. I did a lot of the things that this character is going through in the story.
You see, and what I'd like to suggest is that when he meets the girl,
Sarah in the story.
Sarah, yeah, the punk girl who's taking pictures of herself or having pictures taken of herself in S&M situations. And, well, I think, you see, romances like that begin with, we both know the same thing. We know the work of Lucas Samaras.
Mm-hmm.
And when you find someone who likes the art you like, if you're an art student, it's like finding someone who likes the sex you like.
Right, right, yeah. It's fine. I mean, there's also situations where my sense is that she's much deeper and there's a kind of back and forth between the two of them. He's doing self-portraits. She's kind of delving into much darker, richer situations in her artwork. There's a scene in The Hive where they're very early on, where they were not really a couple yet, but they're sitting on her bed and she's pulling out her notebooks, and there's this whole succession, a series of images that are from all kinds of different sources, some that look kind of punky, some that look, you know, allude to, you know, Catholic imagery, some paintings. But there's a sense that she's kind of introducing him to this, or he's, you know, enamored with her because of this very kind of rich world that she is focused in on.
And also that while she may have been at a darker place than he is at so far, that her darkness is a darkness that's shared wherever you find darkness.
Mm-hmm.
He is wearing a blank Tintin mask,
mm-hmm.
and something is going to happen to him, a raising of consciousness,
mm-hmm.
when you tear off that mask, because there's only so long that you can exploit innocence.
Mm-hmm.
After you pretend to be innocent for too long, innocence rots. And you see something much worse, I think, than simple depravity.
Right. I think part of the protagonist's personality has to do with the fact that he thinks that he's a good guy. He thinks that he's behaving in a good way. What in my mind anyway is slowly being uncovered, that is maybe he's not, he's starting to realize that maybe he's not behaved in a way that's very good, that he's not such a nice guy after all. And that slowly evolves to the stories as well. You've got three books and you're seeing him in as a narrator in three specific points in his life, slowly, you know, growing a little bit older.
I would say I always felt that the artists I like the best really did know something I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was...
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, that it wasn't pretend.
Mm-hmm.
That the fakes
Oh, yeah.
had all sorts of
Sure.
Phony, cheap mysteries.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we were talking about Lucas Samaras, and yeah, he was someone I looked at in school, and you know, I instantly had a connection with him. It wasn't a matter that he was doing something that nobody had ever done, but there was an authority to his voice. There was something that was so personal about the work that seemed truthful about his work. And it went across the board. He did, when you looked at his sculpture, that had that presence and that intensity. And, you know, not that I could even, you know, name what that was or put my finger on what that was. The way that he would examine his body, you know, taking his clothes off and photographing himself in a way that I've never seen anyone do before or since. There was just something kind of a personality that emerged from his work that was so unique.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I mean. There was a Lucas Samaras room in the Albright Knox Museum, mm-hmm. where I went to college in Buffalo. And you can tell, even though at that time, it's very early work,
sure.
it's boxes that can't be closed. They're too full of some mysterious stuff,
right.
grain or whatever, but you can't close them. Mm-hmm. They've been designed not to close, as if the hidden thing cannot be hidden again.
Right.
Now that you've opened the box, it's Pandora's box, and you're in real trouble. And you see, that's what I love. What I love about these books is that so far, you're locating yourself at that kind of apex. Will you be able, in the third book, to find something as eerie mm-hmm. as the secrets have been,
right.
will do for an answer? The next volume is called?
It's called Sugar Skull.
And we've just encountered mysteriously on the last page of this book someone offering those tiny skulls made of sugar mm-hmm. to our hero. And this seems to be a point for him mm-hmm. of initiation, you know. But at any rate, he's about to be induced into something new. Now, he's a person who can't say no.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's part of it. You know, I don't think he's a good man, but I think that he is unwilling to say no.
Well, the sugar skull is, I mean, those, there's a lot of images and imagery that I am drawn towards and interested in. When I was in California, I remember seeing the Day of the Dead, the sugar skulls, that like a celebration of the dead, not fearing the dead, a celebration of the dead, and an acknowledgement of mortality. So there's situations in the book where the protagonist is thinking about his father, his dying father, and trying to come to terms with, you know, mortality. His life is, you know, seeing himself in his father, seeing what he doesn't like about his father and himself. There's a little bit of, you know, looking at a skull, thinking about the skull inside your head, you know, the place that you're going, the place that we're all going.
Well, you know, he's seen underground in a room that Doug is told that the man who looks like his father is in a room where they put the old guys.
Right. The oldies, as he refers to it.
Yes. Yeah. And there are several cultures in here. There are the lizard boys. They seem to be the imperialist slaves of various people who are called the queen. Mm-hmm. And yet they are human queens, not bee queens. There's a lot of implicativeness mm-hmm. going on in this book. I always think, when I encounter these lands, of that place, Pleasure Island, in Pinocchio, mm-hmm. where the bad boys go and they're turned into asses, into donkeys, by indulging in too much pleasure. But here, in this world, it seems to be a kind of Asian world, and penury and poverty seem to be the condition under which people live.
Mm-hmm.
Will he escape?
I shouldn't say yes. I know what happens to him. I know where he walks back up into. Escape in a way, yeah. Escape. There is some escape, yeah. It sounds like I'm being elusive, but...
No, you have to be, and I don't want you to spoil things.
Yes.
But I do want you to reveal something of the condition of knowing things before your readers do. I want you to sound like someone who knows how to tease us.
I guess I am teasing. Yeah, I am teasing people. Yeah.
The pressure is on.
The pressure is on.
I've been talking to Charles Burns, who has written two books of an ongoing trilogy. They are called X'd Out and The Hive, published by Pantheon. And there's one yet to come. It's a delicious state of suspense about something, a question that you know can't be answered. I love conditions like that, waiting for an answer that won't come.
Same here. I mean, that feeling is what I relish when I'm reading any author or watching any amazing movie or looking at, I don't know, a great artist's body of work.
And in your work too, you know. And do you feel safe working this vein?
I feel safe. I mean, I feel safe in the sense of I'm not aware of an audience. I'm not aware of necessarily exposing myself to an audience, or I'm trying not to anyway. I'm trying to put blinders on, and I'm trying to focus on the work itself and not worry about what I'm revealing about myself necessarily. That's what I'm trying to achieve, is a certain amount of honesty and delving into what is kind of a darker side of my personality.
Thank you, Charles, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Hive at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Ellen Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Robbie Dewhurst and Craig Erthine. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Oliver Sacks is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.